Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Good evening. This year's Dublin Theatre Festival has been, by common consent, the most successful yet. Box office records have been spectacularly broken, and the critical reaction to most of the productions, both of classics and of new plays, has been unusually favourable. There's a genuine feeling of work well done, of a small miracle achieved on a shoestring budget. But, and it's a very big but, isn't it all a bit of a flash in the pan? A two-week feast in a year of theatrical famine? A well-stocked Christmas shop window filled to bursting point with 12 months' rations? Brendan Smith, the festival director, will have none of this. Here, he claims, is an old and discredited argument. In fact, the festival, he says, has over the years more than justified its existence, and deserves well of the profession as a whole, and indeed of all who care for the theatre in Ireland.
It has brought Irish people and Dubliners particularly into the theatre, people who have never been inside a theatre before in their lives. It has attracted outside interest in Irish theatre. It has proved to be, I know this is somewhat sometimes to our detriment, but it has been a springboard for Irish actors getting work abroad, Irish dramatists having their wares displayed and presented abroad. And in fact, I would also like to add here that we have made the point in the last 5 years that we are concerned with the Dublin Theatre Festival being a peak point in a very healthy and thriving Irish theatre. To our mind, the theatre festival is quite pointless if it is just a type of oasis in a desert. It should be part and parcel and the peak point of a very healthy theatre throughout the year. And that is why I'd like to say that the Dublin Theatre Festival Council were the first people to bring to the notice of the government the need for subsidisation of theatre throughout the year, not alone at festival time.
Well, now, there are a number of things you've said there that I'd like to take up with you. But before saying that, surely there remains this fact that for 2 weeks, say, in the year, people have a plethora of plays to go to. Nobody can possibly get to them all. There's this vast sort of embarrassment of riches. Nobody who's seriously interested in the theatre can really get to see them. And in fact, is there not some truth in the fact that what you're providing is a tourist gimmick?
No, we say that the theatre festival is a cultural and tourist promotion. And certainly after the second year, I'm stating that in order of priority. It is primarily a cultural promotion, and Bord Fáilte are not at all upset by the fact that tourist promotion is now second consideration.
As a matter of interest, how many tourists do you bring into the country?
It has reached the point where we bring in over 3,000. It's about 3,200 this year, for example. But that in itself, if you reckon per tourist, a spending power of about £55 to £60, including transportation and hotels and theatres and whatnot, gives you a very big turnover for the city and represents a very good return on Bord Fáilte's backing for the festival.
How do you know they're genuinely coming to visit the theatre festival? Are they not taking advantage of some packet job?
No, I'm not saying that they're all here primarily for the festival, but the point is that there's a certain percentage of the figure I've named who do come primarily for the festival. We know that from correspondence and from the booking form sent in from abroad. But the fact remains that it's still justifiable as a tourist promotion in that we have this great if you like, spate of theatrical activity at a particular time of the year, and of course it enhances the value of Dublin as a tourist point.
But still, isn't the festival an oasis in a desert, in Brendan Smith's phrase? Not my phrase, says Smith. It's what our old-fashioned critics say, and they're wrong.
There are three, I would say offhand, or even four, periods of intense theatrical activity in Dublin at the moment, and that's represented by very full houses during these periods. 5 or 6 weeks after Christmas, 4 or 5 weeks after Easter, the peak point in the tourist season, say from the middle of June to the middle of September, and the period of the Dublin Theatre Festival itself.
But surely some of these periods are concerned with what can only be marginally called theatre. I mean, they're concerned with variety, they're concerned with pantomime, and I'm not saying that I don't enjoy pantomime or variety, but how far is this really theatre?
Well, now, I may have to take a personal view here, but theatres are places of entertainment first, in my opinion. They are also, and should be, at least for some other time, places of stimulation, artistic stimulation, stimulation of thought, etc. But I'm afraid that it's the height of nonsense, in my opinion, to say that, every theatre building in the city must concern itself all the year round with catering for eggheads.
One is not talking about catering for eggheads. Surely this is falling into a ridiculous sort of highbrow, lowbrow dichotomy, which isn't the invention of highbrows, but is in fact the invention of managements. And incidentally, if I may make a very personal remark, isn't there a certain sense in which you, sir, are yourself so concerned with the management of one theatre that you could hardly be regarded as taking an entirely objective view either about the festival or about the picture as a whole?
Well, to give you a case in point, this year with the festival, I, of course, must naturally drop out, both in terms of planning or publicity or administration, of any active participation in the running of the Olympia Theatre, where I'm chairman of the leaseholding company at the moment. But for this year's festival, we had a choice of four productions for the two big theatres over the festival period. And I spoke to the booking director in the Gaiety, was Fred O'Donovan, and I said, these are the four plays that we propose for the Gaiety and the Olympia, unless there be any recrimination afterwards, which two do you want? That's number one. Now, secondly, as far as finances are concerned, there's a standard arrangement which is known to the council and to our accountants that in the case of the Olympia, that the Olympia is paid by the council all their outgoings amounting to some under £850 per week, plus a standard profit per week of £150. And in the case of the Gaiety, we this year are paying a rental of £1,500 a week.
My heart bleeds.
For whom?
Still, there is the point, while not suggesting that there is anything venal in your approach to this, still you do in some way represent the management side of the business, don't you?
Well, I mean, I must earn a living throughout the year. And I can assure you, if you'd like to ask me what my fee is for the festival, I'll be very happy to tell you.
Tell me.
I'm actually on a fee at the moment of £1,100 per year, with £400 expenses, £200 of which has to be vouched. And that is my fee and my arrangement with the festival. I obviously earn a living outside the theatre festival. I have to. And I'm very fond of my creature comforts at the moment. I'm concerned with the management of the theatre. I'm also concerned as an independent impresario producer. In some of these projects, I make money. In others, and this has been the case the last 2 years, I've lost money. But I'm also involved, of course, with the drama school, which is the largest in Ireland. And we've just celebrated our 25th anniversary this year. and I'm a little involved in commercial radio. And I think, really, that's on a quite another level. If you like to go, say, let's take the position of an actor, a freelance actor in this country, that's how he makes up his living. He works for theatre, he works in films, and he works for radio.
Irish actors, freelance and otherwise, have a trade union. It's called Irish Actors Equity. And the secretary of this union, Dermot Doolan, takes a gloomy view of the whole scene.
Frankly, I think the only thing that will wake us all up is if the house closed notices went on all the theatres and they all closed down for a week or two in order that we could air our views and make sure that the people in the right places would realise how serious and critical the theatrical situation is. I believe that if we had, President Johnston here, that he would declare the theatre situation here as a disaster area in need of immediate aid, because I don't think the situation can continue if we're trying to influence people abroad that we still are the cradle of genius for the theatre, producing actors and playwrights. We've been doing this on a shoestring, and I think our greatest natural resource is in our writers and in our actors. And I think that film festivals are all right, music festivals are all right, but they're really not indigenous to the country. Whereas drama, we have a tremendous international reputation abroad. The Abbey, no doubt, has hit the high spots once more and must be taken seriously in art form. And therefore, we're not really doing enough at home to foster this.
But Whitner, you've said the Abbey is hitting high spots, and we certainly have seen some very interesting work in other theatres over the last few weeks. Why are you taking so gloomy a view?
Well, this is the festival, actually, is the Cinderella. This is where she gets the magic wand and goes to the ball. But 12 o'clock midnight is the famine. And from then on, you have no fairy wand by way of subsidies. And as long as you have no subsidies and no support for the theatre, you're going to have this ridiculous Mickey Mousing, as I call it, where people are putting on shows on a shoestring. They can't be mounted properly. They can't be mounted. They can't be rehearsed sufficiently. The actors are not getting a living wage out of it. £5 a week for rehearsal money. And we tomorrow, as a trade union in Equity, could straight away demand a living wage for all our actors in the theatre here. But what would happen is we close the whole industry, or the small industry.
Well, now you've said several mouthfuls there. One thing I'd like to take up with you, first of all, you seem to be talking a little with two voices. You're talking about standards, and you're talking with the culture man's voice. You're also being the trade union official, and you're saying that, in fact, you have actors here on less than living wages. Now, which are you mostly interested in? Which do you think you should be interested in? And in fact, if you are a trade union secretary, and if Equity is a real trade union and has been in existence for as many years as it has, surely if actors in Ireland are not getting living wages, are not making a living out of the theatre, surely it's Equity's fault.
Well, you also said a mouthful. And the situation is this, that what is artistically good is economically good. We've always found this in relation to the business. And first of all, if you cannot pay a proper living wage to people, how are you going to attract the right type of recruits into this business? We are not definitely attracting or recruiting the numbers that we should be recruiting. We are losing them to various other occupations, and this is absolutely wrong. There's no incentive for any graduates of the university to come into this business. How can you promise any kind of a living wage to a person of 19, 20, 21. This is the first problem.
Yet still they do come in, don't they?
Well, this is absolutely true, because most actors actually feel that they are quite insane to be in this business. And this is one thing that I would absolutely agree with them, because there is no security. They have less security than a building worker. And you ask me then, what is equity doing about it and what can equity do about it? Well, I think it's getting to the point where we will have to face up to the facts of life and say that, quote an oft-repeated phrase, that if an industry cannot pay a living wage, it should close down. And our feeling is that unless we declare the place a disaster area, then it's no use continuing, because economics are tied up with artistic endeavour. If you haven't got the money, you cannot put on the good shows. And success breeds success. And if you're going on and putting on underhearse shows, badly mounted shows, and you're back to the beginning. It's useless.
And do you think we are doing too many shows that are substandard in these ways?
Well, I think that even the festival suffers very much from lack of rehearsals. The Moscow Arts, I think, spend 5 months rehearsing a play. With the Abbey schedule, for instance, in its normal period of weeks, they most certainly don't spend 5 weeks doing a play.
From what Dermot Doolan has said, the life of the actor or actress is by no means a happy one. Is it that bad? Maureen Toll?
It's a very rough life, and this sort of attitude people outside the theatre have, that it is a glamorous, a sort of Hollywood thing, you know, all the dressing up and the acclaim one might get, you know, playing good parts. It's all very hard work, and even when you get a good break, you know, as I have been getting lately, very good breaks and very nice parts, this, you have to really perform after the show as well.
And as we've been saying in RTE lately, around-the-clock job.
Well, around-the-clock indeed, because you generally have to go home and study your next job, or if you're not studying, you're worrying about it.
Well, now, you know the good remark in Dublin, the traditional remark in Dublin, if by some chance somebody actually does praise somebody for something, there is always the man who will say, but isn't he well paid for it?
Oh, yes, yes, there's this attitude. Well, now, that, I'm afraid, does not really apply in Dublin. I suppose at times you can be well paid compared to the sort of ordinary man on the street salary, but remember, we do not work week in, week out, and sometimes one job has to last 3 months. You have to eke out your salary. We only get £5 a week rehearsal salary. It doesn't even pay for your meals in town. Actors are not well paid in this country, really, or anywhere else, unless you're in the big time films, you know. But even going across to England and doing television, for which you're quite well paid, by the time you've paid your fare and come back at weekends to see your family's all right and paid your digs in England and at the same time run your home here, there's nothing left. There's no such thing as saving.
The groceries and the shoes.
And the boy's school bag and the school books. And you really must have a car if you work fairly hard. You feel you, number one, you deserve a car. Number two, with the late nights and that, late rehearsals after the show, having to go out to supper with people, you must have a car, because otherwise it costs a fortune in taxis. And there's all that, you know?
Well, if you, with all these expenses and all that, is there a great pull to work in a company?
In a company? Well, I think it's very good to work in a company for a while, but not if it gets you into a rut. I think it's very necessary to get away from the same people and to work with different directors. I think the Abbey Theatre now are doing marvellous things, and I think it's about time, being the National Theatre, inviting ex-Abbey actors back to play, inviting prominent directors from other countries like Hugh Hunter, this lady from Moscow. I think this is terribly important for actors, because they get into this dreadful rut. It's a sort of an apathy develops within a company, and this is the only danger, I think. Otherwise, I think it's marvellous to have permanent companies. I wish there were more. I wish there were two or three more, with, say, a nucleus of five or six actors and sort of drawing from the rest of the Irish theatre.
Neil Thobeen has experience both as a member of a company and as a freelance actor. Would he, to paraphrase Noel Coward's famous question to Mrs. Worthington, would he put his son on the stage?
Would I put my son on the stage? I don't know whether I would or not. I certainly wouldn't stop him from going on the stage, because I think that anybody who goes on the stage, if he feels that he must and has the talent and the good sense to realize within a reasonable time whether he's going to make a success of it or not, should do so. Certainly there is nothing more rewarding than to have a success in a part. On the other hand, it's very difficult, particularly in Dublin, and after all, Dublin is Ireland as far as the professional theatre is concerned, to have a run of successes which will allow you to make a decent living, particularly if you have heavy commitments by way of children, wives, houses, even cars, which may be necessary. And it's very, very difficult for an actor to maintain a decent standard of living on the stage alone in Dublin, no matter how good he is. And in fact, the better he is, to some extent, the more difficult it may become as time goes on. Now, I myself am on the open market, so to speak, only about a year and a half, 2 years. And I have myself been personally very successful financially, also, I think, artistically. But I do have the feeling now and again that, well, all right, you've had 3, 4, maybe 5 fairly good successes artistically. You've got very good notices, you've played to full houses and so on, but people are bound to get fed up of you if you keep appearing too often. And the problem then is, what are you going to do if you have no further stage commitments, if managements get tired of, say, oh, well, you know, he's been on too often, we want somebody new. You turn to television, and here again the problem of overexposure is one which is very common. Radio acting as such is not lucrative, unless you happen to be a member of the rep company, which I was for 14 years, which provided a steady income and eventually drove me through boredom and for other reasons which I prefer not to discuss now, into going into the wide open spaces. And this is the big dilemma. One goes into the wide open spaces, one gives up the regular income for the greater personal and professional satisfaction of appearing on the stage and being a freelance or a maverick or whatever word you want to use. But, to mix metaphors, the well dries up.
Ruth O'Mara is a stage manager. It's not exactly an overcrowded profession in Dublin. How does she find the going?
There should, in theory, be plenty of work. But in fact, anybody can just come in out of the street without any experience or any training and get a job as a stage manager. And this, I think, equity should stop.
Well, now, are there recognised scales of pay and so forth? There is no such thing, I suppose, as a recognised apprenticeship system or anything of that nature?
No, there isn't, and I think there very much should be. As regards salary, that is entirely up to the individual to get as much as they possibly can.
Well, now, there would be, of course, a basic difference between people who are on a resident staff in a resident theatre as stage managers, between stage managers in that sense and stage managers who just come along for a given show done by a given company.
Oh, yes, I am talking entirely of freelance stage managers, such as myself. A resident stage manager, as the Abbey has, it's a different thing. They've obviously agreed terms and so forth before they accepted the position. And that's as, like any other job, they even get 2 weeks' holiday a year. It's not at all comparable with the freelance stage manager, which I am.
Well, now, how do you see that the position could be improved? Because I take it you regard the position not alone as unsatisfactory for yourself, but for the theatre.
Oh, very much for the theatre, because, and particularly indeed for the actors, because eventually they suffer. If an inexperienced person is stage managing a show, naturally they'll make mistakes because they are inexperienced, and therefore the actor suffers. They've got to put up with a curtain falling on their head or a telephone bell not ringing when it should ring, and it's just not fair to the actor.
But what do you see as a possible line of solution?
Well, as I say, there are enough of us with experience to cater for every show that's put on in Dublin, and indeed I include variety, without having to bring in semi-pros, amateurs, inexperienced people, purely because they may accept £5 less a week than I would or anybody else would.
But surely you get the protection of your trade union, of equity or whatever. It can't be all that of a jungle.
Theoretically, yes, but in practice, no.
Jim Fitzgerald, as a director, feels that the devil came in originally with the actor-manager. He condemns the whole idea of commercial theatre, root and branch.
Commercial theatre on the West End or American pattern is so corrupt that it has corroded and finished any idea of what the theatre actually is. The theatre is both an art form and, in a sense, a communication form. Now, anyone can stage a spectacle. Anyone can stage a circus who's got enough artists, trapeze artists or whatever they are. Anyone can do this. This is not what theatre is about. Until we decide, which most civilised countries have decided, even the major capitalist countries such as America, have finally realised that theatre as an art cannot exist while the main motive for its presentation is profit. So I say that the commercial managements here, and these are the ones we're presumably discussing, people for whom I have great admiration in one sense, say Phyllis Ryan, Brendan Smith, and the many others, including myself and Godfrey Quigley and so on, who have, as they say, I quote, ironically, kept theatre alive. All this has added up to nothing. We at the moment have no real theatre except a tentative attempt at a theatre in the Abbey. Yes. Popular entertainment is something which you are passive, you don't participate. Now that is the difference between art and popular entertainment. Now we have no art, we have no theatre art here, except fragmentary in the Abbey, and none at all, I insist, none in the commercial theatre, except for the 2 weeks of the festival, and there you're damn lucky if you get it. There have been years in which you haven't got it there, because again, naturally, Brendan Smith's need to make sure that the festival doesn't lose too much of his sponsor's money gets in the way of serious work. We must be prepared to take risks.
Then the logical outcome of what you're saying is that we would abolish the whole idea of commercial theatre.
Not at all. Commercial theatre will exist as long as man exists. Commercial theatre started with the mountebank and the bear baiting pit, and it proceeded on. There will always be the popular entertainer, the comedian, and God help us, we'd be in a bad way without them. But that is not what we're talking about. But
surely it is a fact that commercial managements have, for a profit motive, put on plays here and elsewhere, which have been great plays. Are you suggesting that the whole of the theatre, of the serious theatre, of the theatre that you have defined in terms of this real intercommunication between what goes on the stage and what goes on in the audience, are you suggesting that this should be all handed over to the state?
I am, yes. I think it is absolutely necessary for the state to take entire responsibility for this. If the odd accident happens and a commercial management finds a good play or a great play, and this has happened, it's purely accidental. We can't afford to be relying, for the education of ourselves and our children on accident. And that is what is happening. At the moment, if we get a great play by a commercial management, bravo, I applaud. But it is damn rare because they're not looking for great plays. They're not looking for communication. They're looking for money.
But, Jim, I would suggest that, in fact, what you're saying is the occasional accident has been the rule rather than the exception. Outside, say, of socialist countries, in general, the plays that have been discovered, the plays that have made the history books even, the plays which have not alone won great audiences but won great acclaim, have come from the vision of an impresario who has seen that not alone this is a play worth putting on, but a play out of which he can make money.
What about the great corpus of dramatic literature that exists? Why have my children and yours not had the opportunity to see even these great plays, some of which were discovered by commercial managers? I refer to Shakespeare, Goldsmith, Wilde, Shaw, the rest. How many times in the year do our children get the opportunity to see what the tradition of great theatre is? How many times in the year are they given the opportunity to make a comparison?
Well, I can say this, that when I was growing up, I did get an opportunity to see these plays, quite a lot of them anyway, when Annie McMaster was in the field. Well, Annie McMaster was not subsidised. Annie McMaster was, in fact, that nasty thing, a commercial actor-manager.
Even any current commercial manager will tell you that it is no longer possible to tour plays successfully unless they're pop plays. You cannot do what McMaster could do in the 30s and 40s, as magnificently he did do. You can no longer run a company at the gate as Lord Longford did, Lord Longford being himself a private sponsor, spending at that time about £3,000 a year to keep a company going and presenting classics continuously. This is simply a matter of economics. It is no longer possible.
It was possible once, as Hilton Edwards recalls.
In those days, when one was young, and one could put on more or less shoestring productions, using rather more imagination than cash, there was a possibility that with very great care and very great economy in living, you could just barely get through. But for a long time after we were playing here, we found that really the theatre was not at any time running on an economic basis. As you know, Lord Longford came along at a certain time and bought up some outstanding shares, and he was very generous in keeping the theatre going for some time. But this eventually meant a separation of policies. But then we found, even when we were doing very good business here, as our standards improved and more money was spent on productions and salaries grew higher, that for a long time we were really subsidising the gate ourselves by our sort of what I might call extramural activities, McLearmore's books and me doing shows abroad and later on television abroad and McLearmore doing his own shows abroad. And this, of course, naturally could not go on. As it now stands at the present moment, it is almost impossible, and in the Gate Theatre, to play plays with any standard at a profit. It's certainly impossible to put on plays of the old standard. For instance, I cannot afford big Shakespearean casts, or casts like The Old Lady Says No, or Shakespearean plays, or experimental plays. And one has to confine oneself to plays with rather small casts. Now, there are many very good plays with small casts, but I don't think enough to give one a pick to choose a whole season. And even with these, it's rather like this. If you have a success, you get through with a tiny scrap of profit. If you have a failure, you can lose literally hundreds at the gate here, which means to say that a success cannot pay for one failure. And one would have to be God to be able to put on consecutive successes.
Well, now, apart from the obvious problem of the gate, of the obvious problems of the theatre with the small seating capacity, apart from this altogether, do you feel that the situation, the overall situation, the overall economic situation has changed, not just in degree but in kind over the last 40 years? Do you feel that there are new kinds of problems?
Oh, I think so. And I think to a great extent television has affected it. Television's affected us in two ways. First of all, it has given the actor a better standard of salary, which he certainly deserves and should have. There's no question about that. Because take it in the theatre now, the amount of salary an actor gets for rehearsal is quite criminal. criminally low. But at the same moment, it makes all the difference between profit and loss. For us, we cannot compete with it. Now, television naturally gives better salaries, and actors, therefore, must be free to take television jobs here, and even with better salaries still in England, which means it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to keep a company together as a unit any longer. And this affects us tremendously. Secondly, I think television's affected us because it's taken a certain degree, I won't say the cream of the audience by any means, but it's certainly taken, shall we say, the top off the audience. And there are a great many, many people who would normally have come to the theatre who now say, oh, well, it's a wet night, I can't find parking, or I don't want to stagger into town again, I'll put on my slippers and watch the television. And if I don't like television, Aaron, there may even be a neighbour set that has the BBC. I know this, of course, is Liz Measure. But there we are. But so in these two ways, the television has affected both our audience attendance to a certain extent, and it has also, to a much greater extent, affected the salary scale. I think quite rightly, because I think the actors should get better salaries, but it means that we just cannot compete for the simple reason, although our prices have been raised, they may have been raised at the very most doubled over the last 20 years. But the salaries have quadrupled and gone even higher still. And I think that hardly any theatre in the world now can continue without some form of subsidy. I quote, for instance, the bigger theatres, the Berlin Ensemble, the Comédie Française, the Odeon, the Stratford-on-Avon Theatre, the Royal Court Theatre, the Abbey Theatre.
And what return does the Abbey give us for its subsidy? Here is the manager, Phil O'Kelly.
Well, the first thing that the Abbey gives in return is a permanent company. At the moment, we are the only permanent company in Dublin, and that is quite a costly item on the Abbey. Most of our subsidy is spent, of course, in salaries. But because you're cutting against the first law of economics of the theatre, which means that when you have a small cast, you're not paying other people. But here, if we have a one-man show on it, it costs us the same as a big cast play.
You mean you pay your actors all the year round?
We do, yes.
How many of them?
There's 26 at the moment. But I think that this is probably the most important item here, is that the company is permanent, that you've seen it in Cherry Orchard. Even Siobhan and Cyril, although they've been away for us a while, have given the ensemble player playing with our actors. Now, this would not be possible if we had actors in for short seasons or if the actors changed from month by month.
You said you have 26 actors, but yes. Your payroll is, I presume, rather larger than that.
Oh, it is. You take at the moment, we have a cast of 42 on this week in the Gaiety Theatre. We have, a cast of two, fortunately enough, in the Peacock, and then we have Cherry Orchard on in the Abbey. So that we do use other people, but you must have the permanent company as your company. Of course, we have a very large stage staff, an electrical staff, we have a maintenance staff, we have a wardrobe staff, we have, of course, the usual front-of-house staff, and administrative staff. And as you know, one of the problems about the cost is that in business which have a very high labour content, that they are being hit very badly by the rising costs. Much more than a place which has a small labour content.
Well, do you think then your subsidy is adequate?
I don't at the moment, but...
What is it, by the way?
It's £48,000 per annum. But I don't think we should say a subsidy should be such and then work accordingly. I think we should get the subsidy for something we really want to do, not say we have the money, now let's see what we will do with it. And, I'd say, unfortunately, apart from the new work we're doing, that, as I said earlier, that the high labour content, our costs are going up for even the work that the Abbey did, say, 2 years ago, cost as much, much more now. But if you're going to do extra work, and we hope to do extra work, you need more money for that.
What sort of extra work?
Well, the first thing is to tour Ireland. We did a good tour last year. We didn't tour so much this year because we were touring abroad. But I think we have a duty. We're not a municipal theatre. We are a national theatre. Therefore, we must tour more in the air and Cork, Limerick. We've been in Belfast. We hope to go back there again. That is the first thing for which we would also hope to set up some type of a theatre workshop in the Peacock, which would require more money. We have a plan for children's theatre, not so much children's theatre, as rather bringing school children to the theatre and there giving them the history of the theatre and the Abbey's place in such a history.
By the way, it reminds me of this question of young people getting to the theatre, young people without much money getting to the theatre. And already I've been talking about the price of seats. You peg the seat price as still quite low.
We do.
Is this deliberate?
It is. It is our belief that that any price we have, any seat we have, whatever it may be priced, should be within the pocket of anybody in the country. Therefore, we have a 12 and 6 top. We also give a reduction of a shilling on the 5-shilling seats, which is very low, 5 shillings, but we even reduce it to 4 shillings for students. We could increase our revenue by putting up our prices, but I don't think we should.
Well, now, therefore, it looks as if you would say you have a case for more money to do the things that you want to do. How does this figure of 48,000 compare with what theatres in other countries that are subsidised get?
Well, myself and Tomás McConnell were on a tour of Germany, and we visited 15 different theatres and spoke to the intendantes there. I was speaking to the man in Hamburg, and I asked him what his subsidy was. He told me that he had got an increase, and it was now £1.5 million. So he asked me what my subsidy was, and I, trying to make it look bigger, said 500,000 Deutschmarks. Well, he said, no, not your salary. What is your subsidy?
And what about the men who write the plays for the Irish theatre? Or can one realistically write for the Irish audience? Brian Friel?
I think this can be one's only concern is writing for an Irish market. I think once you attempt to write for an English or an American market, first of all, you're going to write badly, and secondly, you're going to cater for no audience at all. I mean, I feel very strongly about this. I think that an Irishman can write best for an Irish audience, and I have a very strong belief that the more truly you write for an Irish audience, the more intelligible this will be for an audience anywhere in the world.
But is it realistic to think of an Irish audience economically?
Well, if you mean by that, can you write plays which will go on for 6 or 7 weeks in Dublin, and can you live on this? The answer is no, you can't. But I think that if you write very truly and very perceptively, I'm not speaking of myself now, but if one writes very truly and perceptively and honestly about Irish people, you then create people who are intelligible and understandable to people in Russia or Sweden or New York or wherever.
The only way to achieve the universal is by making the particular live.
I think this is absolutely true, yeah.
To revert to the economics of the situation, do you think, though, that the rewards in the Irish context alone give at least even a sort of a bread, if not butter?
I think they give nothing. If you're fairly prolific and say write one play every 12 months, which is very good going, the most you can hope for, unless you write, say, Barstool Boy, but in the average play, if you write one play a year, the most you can hope for is a 7-week run, perhaps a radio version on Radio Éireann or the BBC, and this will not give you enough to keep you in shoe leather.
Do you think that the state, or public patronage in general, then should help on this? Because, after all, it takes a playwright a while to be established, and if he's going to work fully professionally, he probably needs support in the early stages anyway.
Oh, I think he certainly does. This is where state aid is needed, for not only for the Abbey Theatre, but for at least two other theatres, where a man can have one play, say, in the Abbey repertory, a new play being done, say, by the Phyllis Ryan Productions or by some other company, or by the Gate Theatre Productions, and which means that he will have a small income coming then two or three times a year from two or three different sources.
Well, do you see this coming from a general sort of assistance to theatres rather than direct assistance to the playwright in the way of prizes or premiums or what?
No, I don't. I'm not in favour of premiums or prizes, but I think that if the theatre is flourishing by state subsidy, in two or three different houses. I think this is the best way to subsidize the playwright.
But is there a genuine community, a genuine theatre community to write in and for? Here's Eugene McCabe, if you can hear him.
I think that's growing. I think the Abbey is on the up and up. I was in Glasgow for 6 months. I sat through one of the finest productions of The Tempest that have been done in Britain, and there were 20 people in a theatre that holds 1,000. I think this couldn't have happened in Dublin. And I have been listening for so long to this whole business of the theatre being dead in Dublin and, you know, the Dublin Theatre Festival being lipstick on a painted corpse, that when I went to Glasgow and I saw in this enormously wealthy, clanging city how poorly the good theatre was attended, I realised that Dublin is quite a theatrically-minded city and doing quite a good job. That's quite a following.
Do you think that there's enough money, however, which in the long run is what makes the world go round, even in the arts, even in theatre, perhaps especially in theatre, that there's enough of it coming through to, well, even to playwrights?
Well, I suppose playwrights have to depend on the number of times our plays are done. And I can't quibble about this. I mean, if my plays aren't being done continuously, I'll just have to try and see that they are done. The kind of money that I would like to see going into drama is, you know, more money for the Dublin Theatre Festival, more money for the Abbey, more money for struggling managements, this kind of thing. And then the playwrights who happen to do work which is good and is liked will get, you know, the wash of this.
Do you think this money should come directly from government or should come from the people through higher seat prices or what? Or both?
Well, I think you've got to keep the seat prices down if you want the public to come in. I think it must come from the government, I would think preferably through an arts council or through a responsible body of people who understand what drama is, what literature is.
The background was the crowd at the opening of the new Lyric Theatre in Belfast last night week, when Mary O'Malley put on 4 Yeats plays. It's a lovely theatre, but afterwards, when I congratulated Mary O'Malley on the fulfilment of a dream of many, many years, I asked her, is there really in Belfast an audience for this kind of theatre?
When we started 17 and a half years ago, you had 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 people coming to see the sort of play which we are doing now. Now we've an audience which I believe will fill this theatre for 2 or 3 weeks. And that's something like 1,800 people, and I think it's possible, 1,800 people in a week, to see a play of Yeats or a play of Chekhov or a modern English play. Yes. I wouldn't be any more ambitious than that, though. I think we'd be very unwise if we were. We might have to change our policy if we build a larger theatre. I think we've just about catered for the need.
You think, then, that you can help to create a community of theatre-going in a city which, if I may say so, is famous or notorious for the fact that community-wise, to use the horrible expression, it's not all that integrated?
We have created an audience, an integrated community, as far as we are concerned. You must remember we work with all classes, creeds and kinds, happily. And these very people, and it's the private individual who has built this theatre, we've collected £80,000. And when a man on an average salary, 2,000 a year, can give me £500 out of it for a theatre, he must feel very keenly about that theatre. It must mean a lot to him. And it's the man on the street who has built this theatre for us, not industry. Industry has not been all that generous. They're greatly overloaded at this particular moment, I think. They have given a certain amount, but they have not by any means contributed the bulk of the money. The man on the street has done this. £80,000, £20,000 came from the Arts Council. The rest was £60,000, of which I would say approximately £20,000 came from industry and £40,000 from the man on the street.
And for the future, the theatre's administrator, Colonel Johnson, had this to say.
From the operational side, that is ordinary day-to-day running, we are hoping that we will be self-sufficient on the money we take from seats. We're 300-seater, and we're going to charge, on average, 10 shillings a seat. There will be 2 rows of seats from Monday to Thursday inclusive, which are 6 shillings. And people who come along and want to make a block booking of 20 seats more on the 10 shilling seat, we'll give them 10%. And we hope that on that, with the ordinary day-to-day running, we shall more or less wash our face. But, may I just go on? But, of course, we can't do it. And therefore, we have talked to the Arts Council of Northern Ireland, who are very sympathetic towards us. And I think that within reason, they will, in fact, subsidise us.
So you would agree that subsidisation is necessary?
Absolutely necessary. I don't think there is a theatre today, let me put it this way, pure, straight theatre, playing just nothing but real theatre, classical theatre, modern plays, which are worth playing, I don't think they will pay their way. You see, you've got to pay your actors equity rates. You've got all the other incidentals of operating a theatre. And these you must meet. And the public, if you're going to make it pay, they've got to come to the theatre and pay a reasonable rate for the seat. And this, I'm afraid, is where you're competing with the cinema and all the other entertainments.
Well, it looks as if the one thing everyone in the theatre is agreed upon is the need for government subsidy. Did I say everyone? Actually, it was in Belfast that I came across one dissenter, Hubert Wilmot of the Belfast Arts Theatre.
Well, I set myself against subsidisation in the general sense because it means that a management hasn't got to fight for their audience. And an actor doesn't even have to fight so much for his audience. If they know that everything is provided by the great God government, the great God authority, or wherever the money comes from, and it comes in irrespective of the amount of audience the theatre takes in, well then I don't think that makes for a healthy theatre or the best of working.
But even Hubert Wilmot would agree with occasional special government assistance. Now, we began this programme with the cross-examination of Brendan Smith and the Dublin Theatre Festival. And it's only right to say now that he, on behalf of the Festival Committee, has produced a detailed plan for the organisation and subsidisation of the Irish theatre as a whole and submitted it to the government. This is what's involved.
Two further companies could be set up in Dublin based on four theatres. Each group, I'm speaking outside the Abbey now, of course, each group would have a large theatre or a large stage and a small stage.
That is to say, the Gaiety and the Gate, as it were, the Olympia and the Ablana.
Yes, or some other form of coupling. It would involve, of course, a number of marriages between theatre companies and production companies. How effective these marriages would be, I'm not quite sure. Now, broadly speaking, I'd feel that this scheme I'm talking about, the Abbey has its own main building and the Peacock. Now, we'll call it Group A. Group B would, say, have the Olympia and the Gate, and Group C would have the Gate and the Iblana. Each of the groups outside the Abbey would consist of roughly 15 actors, two directors, a designer, a management staff, and one playwright who would be endowed for a year. Now, this would involve about 25 people altogether who would all be engaged on an annual basis. My ideas are rather flexible at the moment as to whether they would occupy the large and the small stage in each case jointly, or 6 months one stage, 6 months another stage. But I think the question of touring must enter into this too, in that one of the groups should be committed to touring internally when they're not in Dublin. The other group could be committed to touring externally.
When the theatres were vacated by your companies being on tour, how would you see the theatre premises being used? By visiting companies from overseas?
Well, not necessarily in all cases from people overseas, but I think we must give the somewhat maligned variety people their head. I think they're entitled to their 10 or 12 weeks a year, particularly in the big theatres, and you could encourage possibly new forms of review in the smaller theatres, like the Gate and the Iblana, again, with Irish companies.
Do you see any place at all in this for amateur and semi-professional groups
from other parts of Ireland?
I think the way that we should liaise, and I think the professional theatre world in Ireland should liaise more positively than it does at the moment, or can at the moment, with the amateur movement, is that there should be provision for the engagement of professional directors to direct amateur productions in the country. I am not, and I mean, I'm saying this, I know even at the moment we have a very talented amateur society in the Olympia, but I am not entirely in favour of amateur companies occupying the main theatres in Dublin. I think there are very, very well equipped and adequate halls for that purpose in Dublin.
In general, though, do you think that this whole scheme, and I have to come back in a moment to some of the harder economics of it, does not this scheme leave itself open as being for the benefit of Dublin alone?
Yes, well, I must make the point that we've been rather reduced to that, because the first scheme that I prepared for the Dublin Theatre Festival Council, and which was presented to the government, covered and allowed for a repertory company in Cork and another in Limerick. I think that the important thing to remember here is that most of the professional theatre activity in Ireland is in Dublin at the moment. And I think that we'll have to face the fact that the sums of money that we will get at the start will be relatively small, and I think that therefore they should be concentrated on Dublin. But it's a matter of having a toe in the door, and I think that the next obvious step is to help professional theatre outside Dublin.
What do I hear my friends in Cork and elsewhere saying? Live horse and you'll get grass? Maybe they've a point, and indeed I'm personally very conscious of the Dublin bias, not so much of Brendan Smith's scheme, but of this very programme. Actually, it's simply because I wasn't very long working on it when I realised that the subject of the problems of the theatre outside Dublin needs a separate inquiry, as do the special problems of the Irish-speaking theatre, which I'd also hoped to deal with. I promise to make amends in both these directions in future programmes. But now, a final word from Brendan Smith on the actual cash, hard cash figures involved in his scheme.
Yes, well, we started off by proposing a sum of £120,000 in 1964, again, outside what the Abbey is getting. But, you know, ultimately, and I suppose allowing for increased costings over the next few years, I mean, if a scheme got underway right away, I think, excluding the Abbey again, that some sort of start could be made with a figure of something even as low as £75,000. For a first year, but that would have to swell in about 5 years to, I'd say, 300,000 or a little more even.
And how do you see this being administered?
It will have to be, well, we've recommended that it would be done through a theatre council, preferably, and we have a number of very dedicated, what I might call, non-theatre people on the Dublin Theatre Festival Council, who act in a voluntary capacity. I think they would have to be the people responsible ultimately for the money and the channeling and distribution of it would have to be a number of carefully selected but not theatrically actively engaged people who, of course, in turn, I would have to work with some sort of advisory panel from people acting or working in the profession.
And there is, I understand, a fair chance that this may happen within the framework of the Arts Council of An Chéad le Linne reconstituted.
Well, there's provision being made. It'll involve legislation for actually three councils, one for theatre and literature, another for music, and another for the fine arts, working with a general arts secretariat. And sums of money for each council have even been talked about, and I understand this money is to be used within the current financial year. So we are now very actively baying at the door of the Department of Finance.
Let's hope the bite is as good as the bark.